I didn't think that John and I from Cambio could have a discussion that went deeper than the last one and have more talk about how they make their tequila than what we did tonight. So this interview that you're about to watch is absolutely incredible. And we are going to talk about this amazing tequila right here, their Urban Cowboy Hoven, which is phenomenal. Stick around for this one. I think you're going to love it.
It's Tasting Tequila with Brad.
All right, guys, I had a treat for you guys tonight. One of my absolute favorite tequilas, but most of all, one of the most knowledgeable and fun to talk to people in the tequila world. And even though he's a chef and also on here, he is a somm, but I love that he puts that he's just a tequila dabbler.
It's awesome.
Chef John, how are you doing tonight, my friend?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. I mean, I get to spend the evening talking to you, so how can I go wrong?
Yep, my pleasure, man. It's a lot of fun. I love it.
Well, before we get started, I've had this bottle. I just took the plastic off. I haven't poured it yet. I can't wait to try it tonight with you. So I am going to pour some of your Urban Cowboy Hoven.
I love it.
And I can't wait to try this. I've heard nothing but amazing things. So
super cool.
I'm excited about talking about it and all the other awesome stuff that you have going.
It's funny. I don't even have a bottle. We pull it usually a couple cases of every special one we do, and it's all in Nashville right now. So our guy Andrew down there actually has it, so I don't.
Now, how did you get hooked up with the Urban Cowboy Bar in the first place?
Andrew Hannigan, our market manager for Tennessee and Georgia, knows them really well and knew one of the guys that was working with them to create the program. You know, but one of their newest, I think it's the new one in the arcade, actually has a tiny little agave speakeasy. You've got to walk through like a little walk-in cooler setup in a prep area to get back to it. And so they were looking at doing some special things. And we sat down and we talked for a long time about the way we make our tequila and also the way that we approach barrel programs. You know, I think we do that a little bit differently than most people do. And so we sat down and just went over everything and we talked about what it would be like if we made something. I made a bunch of different samples. You know, we've got roughly 15 barrel types that we use for our different aging. Only four that are used for the flagship, but a bunch that we use for other things that are coming down the road or special versions, things like that. And what we'll do for our bespoke program is we'll take different ages and different barrel types and we'll start blending those things together so that you're really getting a really unique level of complexity. Certainly things change a lot in barrel, but they also change from barrel type to barrel type. So we'll do, you know, usually starting out in 5 to 8 different blends of these different things. And we'll get a direction of where the customer wants to go with it. And this program is always done, you know, with me. So I do it with the customers and with our team. And we make it a really personalized experience. Obviously, you can see by the label, we created a label just for them. The idea behind our bespoke program really came out of, and I see some brands will just put a sticker on a bottle of their normal bottling stuff, right? And I think that's nice. I think that's a little bit easy. And we wanted to do something that was more thoughtful and more intentional, like we do with a lot of the things in our brands. So take all these different blends, put them together, get a sense of what they want. And we keep working on the blend until they get to the point where they're completely in love with it. And when they're in love with it, then we settle and then we bottle it. And we do the whole registration process with the labels. We have our team, our graphics guys in Mexico took an old sign that the guys at Urban Cowboy found. And they kind of said, we want to cut a label like this. So we gave that to the team in Guadalajara. And they created this label based on that sign. And then you got to stick in all the little pieces that each side of the governments need. So
right.
It has to say X, and it's got to say Y. And so we got to stick all that stuff in there. But that's it. And so they've got it running in their places now, and they'll probably use it for this year. And when we get to next year, we'll make something else. And it's really changes all the time, you know, because that one tequila exists right now and we can't replicate it exactly the same way next time. So we'll make something different for them.
So what is the makeup of this? So yeah, I know it's a Hoven. So are we Blanco, Reposado? Right.
Yeah, so it's Blanco and Repo, but it is, because you always have to go by the lowest denominator. So as soon as you put Blanco, the most you could write is a Hoven. If you did a blend of Repo and Añejos and even an extra, then you could just write Repo. But when it's a Blanco and you add an age to it, then it becomes a Reposado, a Hoven. So anything that has Blanco, the most it could be is a Hoven.
I just learned in my class recently that even if you make an Añejo, you can classify it as a reposado if you want.
Yeah, you can declassify something.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't realize that until the class. I actually failed that question twice. Why would you make a añejo and call it a reposado, or make an extra añejo and call it a reposado? But I know now that
you know. Yeah, we just made one. We just made a blend for Metropolitan Grill in Missouri. And the age of the tequila inside the bottle is 16 months, but it's technically a reposado. We blended it with reposado and we put a little bit of, it was like 2.5-year-old añejo inside of it. So it's a repo, but it's more, I think it's maybe 16 months. So it's like a 16-month-old reposado. So that's kind of one of the ways that you get into that. Or if you make añejo and you just think it's not good enough to be your normal añejo, you just declassify it and call it a reposado.
Gotcha.
Doesn't happen very often. Obviously, people always, you know, because añejo commands such a good extra price, but, you know, sometimes you can do it.
You can usually blend something that maybe isn't as good a way, can't you, when you're doing a blend of an añejo?
Yeah, you can. Like when we do... you know, most smaller distilleries will take whatever they have for añejos. Fortaleza is famous for doing this. All their añejos always look different, right? It's whatever barrels they have, they blend them together and that's what they sell. That's really common. Times, you'll get small distilleries that will put a lot of effort in and they'll try to match flavor profile from batch to batch to batch. More difficult to do that. Definitely more difficult for us because our añejo uses three different barrel types and the different ages. So for us, it's a really complicated process for us to, you know, basically start with a framework of the same percentage, but then whittle it down to get to the point where it's really consistent from batch to batch. We've done 4 bottlings now. And I think they're pretty much right on. The second one was like 2% off, but the third one was right on. And the fourth one we just did is right on too. So, I think that's, you know, that's more effort, but I think a little bit nicer.
So I think all of your blends are amazing when I drink your repos and your añejos. So now I'm going to go for your personal taste. So if you were going to pick Blanco just in one barrel type and you were to drink that aged barrel type, what would be your go-to barrel?
God damn, I don't know. Okay, so... it's a toss-up. I wouldn't have said this 6 months ago. Right now, so we have a number of 40-year-old Oloroso sherry casks that we've got stuff aging in that we've never bottled, we've never used for anything. We'll be using it for something that's coming up in the fall. And I thought for the last few years, I'm like, when is this ever going to get around? Like it just kept waiting and waiting and waiting. It was really, really slow to finally start moving. And then we had it like a month ago and my wife and I were just like, Jesus Christ, it's incredible. And you compare the one from 5 months earlier and it still wasn't there yet. So I would say a toss up between the really old sherry casks and our white Madeira casks. And then, I don't know, maybe a white Bordeaux cask. We've got a couple of things, you know, we use the Bordeaux cask for a regular Blanco and for a Reposado and stuff like that. But we've got a couple white Bordeaux casks that we set aside earlier on from some of our earlier productions, and there's some really old tequila in them, and it's really interesting. A lot different than I thought it was gonna end up going. It really just took a long time in the barrels. Now, normally, if you put tequila in whiskey barrels and they're charred, even if they're old, and you leave it there a few years, you get into this part where it really gets either too much like whiskey, or it just tastes like an old barrel. I always say like an old 2x4.
Musty wood.
Yeah, and that's not pleasing. Certainly doesn't taste like tequila anymore. But we noticed that there are, but by using French oak and by using barrels that are old and used for other things, we really cut down on the barrel influence. So we can actually get really long aged tequilas, 3-4 years old, that have a very, very negligible influence. So there are some really interesting things that we've been working on and we've been watching as they evolve. I mean, there's some really neat stuff that we're learning about the way that old French oak that's been used for decades interacts with tequila over time. So there's some pretty cool things coming up down the road. So our first extra will come out later this year.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, well, really...
There's an old school tequila guy that's been around for a really long time that believes, you know, French oak is the only way to go. And in Enrique Fonseca,
yeah,
done a great job taking tequila that's been aged forever.
Yeah.
Blending that together and going, holy holy cow, it still tastes like tequila. Like it does. Just like barrel. So
I had some of this 15-year and out of Dave Titus' place in Phoenix a couple months ago. And he was super generous and just grabbed a bottle and we started sipping on it. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, it's unreal how good it is.
Yeah.
So it's really, really cool. There's a lot of neat things about French oak. And I know that when we first started, we got grief about using French oak from a number of important influencers. And they really questioned, why we do it or why are we using it? Yeah. Well, they certainly think they're important. You know, I'm not really sure how much tequila they sell or how many brands they own, but they certainly think they're important. And so there was always a little bit of argument. People have different opinions about whether French oak is right. But I'll tell you, as a person who has studied flavor and aroma and complexity my entire life, without a doubt, French oak is the right wood treatment for tequila. I say this all the time, but tequila is all about its delicacy and its high tone aromatics. It does not need what I think American oak is like a sledgehammer to spirits, right? And whiskey does well with that. Whiskey needs that. Tequila doesn't. Tequila needs like a nice supporting pillow underneath it to just help lift it a little bit and add a little bit, but not get in the way. And an American oak has a hard time doing that normally. And I'm not saying we'll never use American oak. We do have a couple of small things we've been working on right now. I love rye barrels with American oak. I think those are interesting. But generally, if you make regular everyday tequila and you age it, it just should be in French oak. It's as simple as that. So it'll take a while for the industry to get there. Certainly, we weren't the first people to do it, but I think that, we talk about it as much as we can. And we really want to make sure that people think about the way that you age things, not just how long has it been in a barrel for and what that aging does to it. So I think it's important.
Well, so let's nerd out a little bit. So the difference between an American oak barrel and a French oak barrel, isn't it I may be completely wrong, but isn't it the softness of the wood and how the alcohol goes into the wood and comes out of the wood?
So a couple things about it, just so that everybody who doesn't know understands that part. American oak barrels are always made from American white oak that's from the U.S. And it could be from different places. Tennessee, Kentucky certainly makes a lot. There's a lot from Missouri. But French oak needs to be from France. Barrels are trees are cut down, coopered over there, and then sent over here. One of the differences is in the fineness of the grain. A French oak is different. American oak has a really fat, wide grain. It also is, I'd say, a little more astringent, a little more sappy. And that's one of the reasons why it's used for whiskey and why it holds up well to heavy duty charring, is because of its particular composition. But French oak isn't really for that. It's meant for delicacy. And the wood is supportive and integral. It doesn't, you're not trying to use the wood to make the spirit. You're trying to use the wood to add complexity and ageability to the spirit or the wine or whatever. So they're really meant for different things. And there are some wineries that actually use American oak for their wine too, but they have a similar sort of issue. It's not quite as refined and elegant. And tequila by its very nature is refined and elegant. And so it's the right treatment for it for sure. But the grain structure being different, the way that alcohol interacts with it is a little bit differently. And then generally it's treated differently. So French oak barrels are never heavily charred. At least I've never seen one. I'm sure somebody has made one, but I haven't seen one. And they're generally just treated a little bit differently.
So is it more of a toast than a char of what they
do? Yeah, it's literally a toast. You'll get an extra light, medium, or sometimes a heavy toast. Not very often. Usually it goes to medium or medium plus. And then that's a very different, you're talking about a half a millimeter to a 1 millimeter toast on the inside. So that's a very, very delicate caramelization of the inside of the barrel, whereas a char literally looks like a wood out of a fire pit, like a wood log out of a fire pit.
So when you think about how whiskey and bourbon react with an American oak barrel being aged in, let's say, the Midwest, right, where you have extreme temperature swings, extreme cold, extreme heat, and that's what builds the character of a bourbon. Where when you're aging in, the Highlands or Guadalajara or tequila, you have a much more even temperature, right? It gets cooler, it gets hotter, but you don't have this massive swing. And a lot of people, their barrel houses are in, cellars or a little cooler. You don't have the heat. Do you think that if you pull that out of like one of those cooler areas, the barrel, and you put the French oak in extreme heat, like you do bourbon, would it affect the tequila more and faster than the way it does in the environment that it's in Guadalajara or Arandas?
Yeah, I think it would. The same way that heat and that extreme humidity and extreme heat affects whiskey, the same process would happen. It would be a lesser degree than it does with American oak, but it would still happen. It would still change it dramatically. I think especially aging agave in the Highlands gives you a chance to have a nice, even-keeled, calm aging process. It doesn't have the humidity swings. For most of the year, it's fairly dry, and then it gets moist for some of the year. All the good aging places are either built underground or built into the ground at least a little bit. And then with a nice consistent temperature, I mean, it will get, you know, it'll get to 85 or 90 degrees some days down there, especially up in those altos, but not that often. And it's really nice. And like right now, it's, you know, it's what, 52 degrees or something. Like, it's nice and temperate. My wife and my cousin are down there right now taking care of some family stuff. And so it's nice and cool. You have to take a jacket whenever you go in the wintertime. I think that helps keep tequila the way it's supposed to be. It keeps it from being overdone with the barrels too much. You know, I have seen some aging rooms down in Jalisco where it'll be in a tin roof building in the sun, and the tequila will get really, really hot. And that's a way, you know, you could also use that technique for aging it faster. I don't think that makes it better, but it is a way to age something quicker, to have more barrel influence in a smaller amount of time, right? But you know, aging down there is very, very different than aging really anywhere in the U.S. Even if you're in the dry Southwest or in Texas and you age stuff, you know, it's baking hot with not huge humidity. And then it's a little bit cool for some of the year. And then Kentucky is hot and a little bit cool, but a lot of humidity. And there's guys that, you know, age stuff up in the Dakotas, and whiskey doesn't age the same way up there. As it does in some of the lower states. So it certainly makes a big difference. The part I think that's vastly different from tequila is that we're not looking for 7 or 8 or 10 years of age on it, right? We're looking for a year to 2 to 3 years, generally at most. You know, we're not sitting there trying to get heavy caramelization and heavy extraction of oak flavor the way that whiskey is. So we, you know, a nice calm environment, I think, is better. And just the right amount of time, but the calmer your environment is and using the right type of oak can actually allow you to get a longer time frame, which can build complexity and still not get in the way, of the tequila.
Yeah, I totally agree. Have you ever heard of Carlos Camarena explain the difference between Blanco, Repo, Añejo, and Extra Añejo?
No, I haven't. Not specifically.
Okay. I'm going to give it to you because I think it's awesome. So this right here is an unbelievable representation of what tequila is supposed to taste like. And this is the picture of tequila, of agave, right? So if I'm going to take this and I'm going to age it, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put it in a barrel and I'm going to make a reposado out of it. And what is that reposado? It is a thin, pretty wood frame that if I was going to hang this picture up, I'm just going to put a really pretty red wood frame around it, and you're going to see the frame, but you're still looking at the picture of agave. And now, if I'm going to do añejo, I'm going to make a bigger frame. It's going to have a little more wood around it. It may be, you know, really shiny wood, real pretty, and around there, and that's going to be your añejo. And if I want to make an extra añejo, it's going to be one of those thick frames you see in a museum. Like 3 inches. It's going to have like gold, you know, in the frame. It's going to be really beautiful. And you have a beautiful frame. But remember, nobody goes to a museum to look at the freaking frame. And that.
Dude, I love that. Oh, it's so perfect.
Explanation of aging tequila that I have ever heard.
It is. It is. I'm totally going to work that into all the stuff that I talk about.
Yeah. And when you think of the Camarena,
I'll give him credit.
From Carlos to Felipe, both, you know, they both age in such a light manner, right? I mean, you could bring out this tequila that is aged for 15 years and it's going to be lighter than this Hoban, right?
But yeah.
It is really the picture of what they do. And when I heard that explanation, I'm like, that makes so much sense because nobody's taken a picture of white whiskey and drinking the whiskey off.
Never.
Although we love doing it in tequila, right? I mean, all of us nerds would rather drink it at 70% alcohol in the middle of the hearts than do anything else. So it's, you know, it's completely different than any other spirit. Is the aging is just framing what already is amazing and drinkable. So
yeah,
you'd like that.
I do. It's great. I'll make sure I point out every single time I use that this is this is Carlos's idea. I'm not stealing it from him. I'm just reiterating what he said because I think it's important and I believe in it.
And that's why I put that out there. That wasn't my idea either. That was totally from Carlos.
That's really funny.
I love explaining that to people, you know, at tastings. You know, you have these bourbon bros, you know, and these people that are drinking nothing but aged spirits trying to come over to tequila and getting the depth of understanding of the complexity of the plant.
Yeah.
And then, you know this better than probably most. The flavor factory is totally fermentation and what you're doing there.
Yeah.
And the rest is just framing all that great flavor you've came up with.
Yeah, all barrels should always be a supporting element, right?
Yep.
It should never get in the way. Nothing should ever get in the way but being tequila first. So it has to be tequila first.
100% agree. So you said you've got an XA that'll be coming out this year, you think?
Do. Yeah. I know what it's going to be now. I wasn't sure for a really long time what it was going to be, but I know what it's going to be now. Let's see. And nobody's going to know anything about it. I'm intentionally not going to tell anyone so that it'll be a blend of multiple different things of multiple different ages. And, it's going to go into a bottle with a black label set on it. So it'll be a black on black label. And it's going to say extra Añejo in the bottom and it's going to have my name on the back and that's it.
There's nothing on.
We're so open and transparent about everything. And, you know, we talk about everything we do all the time. I wanted to do one really, really cool special thing that everybody could sit around and argue about what's in it forever and nobody's ever going to know.
That's awesome.
My wife knows, my cousin knows, and that's going to be it. We're going to blend it ourselves in the distillery. We're not even going to let the distillery guys know what it is.
What day are you doing that?
It'll be sometime.
I'm looking up my calendar now to make sure I'm there. That's awesome.
But it's going to be pretty special. I think I'm really excited about it because I haven't really decided, how we were going to do one. And I didn't know it until 2 months ago. So we've been thinking about it for a long time and I wasn't really sure kind of precisely the way we've executed or what would go into it or how we would do it. So, but I got a whole bunch of samples at home and I was tasting through different things. And I made a quick little blend and I gave it to Cecilia and she's like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah. How'd you do that?
And I said, I think that's going to be our extra. Like, I really like it. And she's like, what?
So it was really special. Can you leak what the proof of it's going to be potentially?
It'll be whatever proof the blend is out of the barrel. No dilution.
Okay. So you're just going to do whatever those proofs are from each barrel.
Yeah. Remember, whenever we distill, we always distill down to 51%, right?
Right.
So when we put something in a barrel for 3 years, our one of the really good things about French oak that I don't think enough producers give credit for is the efficiency of it. It doesn't lose tequila through the angel share as much as American oak does because of the fineness of the grain. And if you keep it at a nice cool temperature, you can actually reduce your loss. That's really important, right? Everything that you do and make tequila, the glass is reasonable. The labels are reasonable. The labor to produce everything down in Mexico is reasonable. The agave is expensive as all God's hell. I mean, it's 10 times as much to make a bottle of tequila for the base spirit as it is to make any whiskey. So raw ingredients, I don't mean the finished part.
From grain to a huge difference in pricing.
So the more you can protect the agave, the more profitable you can have or the better price you can sell really unusual things at. So it's important to think about those kinds of things from the production and business standpoint part of it. So anyway, we don't have a whole lot of loss was the point of that. And fuck, I was going to say something else. I just forgot about it.
So in your evaporation that you have where you're losing water, sometimes you have an increase in actual alcohol percentage in those barrels, correct?
Normally you lose alcohol first. Alcohol evaporates easier than water does.
Right.
So your alcohol level will come down as you age it longer. So when we go in at 51, the stuff that I've got sitting downstairs, we pulled out at 49 and a half and 48.
Okay.
So it'll be somewhere between 48 and 50, probably 48 and a smidge more than that, but that'll be whatever it is out of the barrel. So we're literally going to take it out of the barrels, put it into a bottle. We're not going to filter it at all. Not only not chill filtering it, which we never do, but we're not going to even paper filter it. It's going to be a raw cask, undiluted expression. So some people are going to get little bits of some of the cask inside of it. That's just naturally going to happen.
Yeah.
So I think it'll be a really special bottling And it's also not going to be stupid expensive either. We're not going to, you know, I always have been telling everybody lately that all the tequila we make needs to pass the cousins test. But I say that because every time we have a big party and all my cousins come over, my wife hides all of our expensive liquor. And she'll right now sitting downstairs, there's a whole bottom shelf filled with stuff that nobody's allowed to go and touch. And I'm always giving her grief. I'm like, why do you always hide stuff in your family? And she says, well, first of all, I'm hiding it from you also, not just from the family.
Not just from them.
Because you guys will all sit down and you'll knock out three bottles of something we can't get ever again. And so, I think it's important for, for our tequilas to pass the cousins test, where you're always proud to have them on the top of your bar and everybody can share in them. You don't ever want to like wince when your cousin goes to grab a bottle and you're like, oh, there goes my mortgage payment or there goes my car payment, right? So our extra is going to come out and it's actually going to be really reasonable. Well, probably retail at around a bottle.
That's awesome.
And it'll be almost, I think it's going to be a 4 1/4. So 4 months, four years, maybe 4.5 years old. I think so. We're still putting it together. And some things are going to be pulled out of barrel at a different time than others. So the average age will be somewhere between 4 and 4.5 years. So it's going to be a properly extra añejo. And not a 37 month, get it out of the barrel right away kind of a thing. And then charge everybody $300 a bottle. I'd like people to actually enjoy it and drink it and want it to be a part of their normal conversation.
That's exciting. And thanks for doing it that way. Because we do get bottles that we're like, man, I don't want to drink all of that, right? Because
yeah,
I don't want to have to buy it again. Like some of them, there's a big price tag. And then there's others, like when you get these, you're like, hey, my buddy was in Nashville. I'm like, could you bring me back a few of those? Because
yeah,
I'm going to like it. I can't get it here. And I did something different with my top shelf. My top shelf requires you getting out a ladder and standing on the bar and climbing up to get to it. So that gets it away from the cousins too. You drank
it
too much.
Yeah.
No one can stand up there without falling down.
That's funny.
Let's swing back to this a little bit. So what's our blend and what's our product look like that's in this Urban Cowboy?
All right, let me just pull it up real quick.
That was a long talk to come back to where we started.
It was a long talk to get back. Yeah, I know.
Love
to
it.
People that wanted the answer to that question, they're all sitting there saying, come on.
Come on, man.
I'm going to say this thinking that I'm pretty sure what it is. And I'm only saying that I'm explaining it this way because I put together that blend like 8 or 9 months ago, which for me is like 10 years ago. So it is totally going to get it wrong. I know it. So it's 75% Blanco. And 25% white Madeira cask. So it's actually got white Madeira cask that was just shy of being añejo. So it's old Reposado out of a really old white Madeira cask and Blanco blended together. I think that's the one we did. God, I'm probably not. Somebody's going to kill me. I know somebody's sitting there, right? I can feel Andrew yelling at me in my ear. He's like, what are you doing? What are you talking about? Sorry.
Don't I love it. It has a.
I reserve the right to go back and change my answer later.
Change your answer. I'll put it in the details. Just send it to me. It's got a really cool fruity note, a great cooked agave note, but there is like this in the finish, just a nice underlying oak note.
Yeah.
Like once you've drank, like I poured a pretty good pour and I don't have a whole lot left on that pour, that when you go back to that finish, it is a nice, like not overly tannic.
Right.
Underlying woody note that sits on top of all of the other things that have already gone, right? I've already lost the agave. I've already lost the fruit. I've already lost the floral. It's just this nice woody note. And I really.
Yeah. And that comes from using old barrels that have been used for other things before. Also, Madeira is a fortified oxidative wine. So that is going to throw influence a little bit differently than just using just a normal kind of old barrel. And they weren't reconditioned at all. The things that we do. The only barrels that we recondition are the French oak we get from California, and that goes into our Reposado, and that's what we use as the base for our añejo. But most of the other barrels, we'll leave them alone and not mess with their finishes because those natural finishes on the inside don't add a ton of color, but they do add more complex aromas and flavors.
It reminds me in the finish of a Blanco that's been just fermented in wood.
Yeah.
When you have the Blanco and it's not been aged at all, but you still get that like Madeira wood flavor in the finish.
Yeah.
It's like that, but times 10, like it's just way more layered of oak and this nice, like, I'm going to say anise, but like anise tannic type note in the finish. It's just really nice. That is really good and very complex.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And that's one of the neat things we can do with the way that we craft this program is by adding a small amount of something that's been in a really complex barrel that adds a lot to it into your Blanco. You can add multiple layers of complexity without getting in the way of the agave, but also you can keep it where it meets the right kind of price point for the account. Like that was one of the things that was important because they use it for cocktails and because Urban Cowboy uses this all the time, it needed to be something where we could craft this for them that had the complexity and the structure that they wanted and also would meet a price point the right way. So this is all part of the conversation we have, you know, how it gets made and who it's making for and who are we going to sell it to. All of these things matter. We want all these versions to be really successful one-offs for the accounts that are getting them. You know, it's a really personalized program we created. And we turn down people all the time for it. You know, we've got a number of requests from guys in Texas, and we only do one or two per state per year. So maybe 8 or 9 of them total is the most that we would do. Some states, you know, we won't be able to do them for a while because it takes a lot of time and effort and we don't want to duplicate things. So everyone who has a version, I think we've done 5 so far. Everyone who has a version, none of them have ever been repeated. And we don't bottle their version for ourselves either. So that this particular Urban Cowboy, that tequila cannot be had anywhere else in the world. It'll never exist again for anyone else. So every version is wholly unique. We did one for Daniel down in Fort Worth and his pick sold really well. He was super happy with it. And so we made a new one for him. That one we made for him last year, that's going to be last year's version. And this year will be a different version. And each one of them will be completely unique from the other things that we've done before. And I think that's important too. We want the barrel picks to show that tequila can be really broad and diverse and complex and drive interest in the brand. But we also want to balance not being a house that only does custom work, right? Because you can fall into that trap where all you do is make custom projects and nobody buys your core SKUs. And that's an important thing to be able to balance both of those things together.
So you're telling me they put this in cocktails?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to make
it amazing.
I'm going to call 911, and I'm going to get the tequila cop over there to that bar right now and tell them these should only be neat pours.
You know what? I know he was there for the launch. I think you should ask him what he thought about their cocktails because I know that he's had it. So
I know that he talks extremely highly about this tequila. We've actually talked about it, and his comments about it was like, "Damn it, why am I not in Nashville?" Fortunately, a good friend of mine was, and I said, I need a few of these. And then there was an Alma de Jaguar that you can't get in Indiana as well. And I wanted that cool apple brandy. I'm like, I need that to come home with me. I want to try that one. So,
nice. I love it.
We're trying our best to make Indiana like other states and be a great haven for amazing tequila. It's going to take a while, but we're definitely doing as much as we can to make that happen.
Yeah, everything that you're describing takes a while, right? There isn't any easy path to getting Americans back on to proper tequila. It's going to take a while. But I think one of the really, really amazing positive things about our industry is how great that high quality agave is growing. Our level of spirit and quality right now in the entire spirits world is like the only shining beacon in the whole thing. And it's really doing well. And it's really driven by consumers finally demanding a better product. And then all of us responding to that and delivering a better product. So the more consumers that understand it and the more people that talk about it, the more people that question, hey, is your tequila actually clean or not? How do you make it? What's inside of it? Where's the agave from? Is it Highlands? Is it Lowlands? All these questions are great and they all matter. And the more people that learn about that, the more that our whole industry is going to prosper from it. You know, I'm sure that a lot of the big brands look at what's going on right now and they're all upset and angry and frustrated, at least based on what they tell the CRT. That's what we think they are. But really, they should be seeing this as a really positive movement because there's been a couple of times in tequila's history where it's become really popular and then it's been overproduced with really poor quality and then it's crashed. And this is the first time that all the popularity is driven by quality, not driven by just marketing. And in the long run, 10, 15 years from now, all of these big brands, if they can be thoughtful and insightful and they can adapt along with us, they can actually help become part of the story of how Mexico really took back tequila and started making it the way that Mexicans actually make it not the way that it's made by a bunch of multi-billion dollar international companies, because there is no large brand that's owned by Mexicans. There just isn't one. There's good sized medium brands, but all the really, really big ones that drive all the additives, that drive all the marketing, that lie to consumers every day, none of those are owned by Mexican companies, right? So, you know, this is finally like the right movement to get people into proper tequila again, and really return the spirit to its heritage and to its tradition. And that's certainly something that we want to be an important part of.
You know, it's so cool that you say that. When I was down in January and we were just chilling in the rooftop pool at a bar or a hotel called Gloria Agave. Gloria Agave is a really beautiful little hotel that's right on the outskirts of the town of Fortaleza. And we were chilling in the pool, drinking a bottle of Don Filano, just kind of spending our afternoon because we had an open afternoon, a busy evening. And two of the people in the pool were both employees of Cuervo. And
interesting. And they just go.
Well, no, they were very interested in what, you know, the content that we do and why there's this philosophy around the brand, and really good, open, awesome conversation.
Oh, that's cool.
And a few minutes later, I look up and Ted Genoways walks into the pool area, and that is the author of The Tequila Wars.
Yeah.
And Ted's like, dude, you know, I watch your videos. I'm like, I love your book. Like, you know, so we had this like little bromance, if you will. And we had a great conversation. We sat there for a few hours and ended up just being us and Ted. And I said, what are you drinking? And he's like, this is called La Rocas 1906. And I'm like, okay, tell me about it. And he's like, taste it first. And he poured it in a glass. And I'm like, that's pretty solid tequila. That's pretty good. What is it? And he said, this is Cuervo and the Beckman family saying, we want to make a tequila that Jose Cuervo would have drank. So
nice.
Stone oven, roller mill crushed, wild fermentation, copper distillation, absolutely no diffuser, blended in, only for sale at the store. And he's like, it's a test pilot for them to go back to show that they can make a tequila that is authentic. I was going to bring it home because I was going to do a video about it. Like I'm not going to drink. No, I drank it all.
Yeah.
It was solid. Like, it's the first time I've ever said I've drank a Cuervo tequila and went, this right. is a solid brand. This is a solid taste. And I've had a couple people that have had like the Dobel that, you know, the Bel Tejona that they've made. And, you
yeah.
know, it's.
I wish they would have left it additive free. They didn't, but exactly. I wish they would have.
So when we go back down, I didn't know where to buy it at. I didn't ask Ted the right questions. Where do I get this, right? Ted just gave me the bottle and we finished it. So it's like at one of the stores at La Rojas, you know, they're in the town of Tequila at the front.
Yeah.
And he's like, go a bottle. And because I want to bring it home and I want to pour it again. What I like, you tell me if this is something, a good way to do it. So I come home and I know something is like a baseline, right? The El Tesoro Blanco. I'll pour that as a base, and then I'll taste through other tequilas. And I want to do that with this. I want to pour a Valles base, agave, tequila, and then taste against it. Because it's one thing to taste it in a pool and go, that tastes good. It's another thing to straight compare or even blind it, you know, in something you know is clean.
Yeah. Blinding it is always the best way to remove any preconception you have, right? Because if you really don't know what something is, you have no place to judge it from, especially with something like agave and in its Blanco form, because they're all going to look very similar. So the only thing you're going to have is the aroma and the flavor that's in the glass. You're going to get some things out of the texture by looking at the way that it falls out of the glass. But other than that, you just have what's in the glass. And you don't have anybody's, I like this, or I don't like this, or I think this is good. All that stuff is gone. So it's always a really positive way to do it. When we do our blendings, we do them all blind. So I'll make up a bunch of different versions and we'll pour them in glasses and then we'll mix all the glasses around. And then someone else will come and mix all the glasses around and we'll go back to it. We'll taste everything, make notes on it, see what it's like. And then we'll choose what we think is the closest match or wherever we like the most. And then we look in the bottom of the glass and see what we wrote in the bottom. So it's a way to remove your preconceptions. And it's hard to do, right? Because even if you know something is Cambio, you know that you're going to like it. Even right. if you're like, this isn't my favorite, I really like it, right? So going into it, you know that. But, you know, if you have something and you don't have any preconceptions, you're only judging by what's in there. So it's the most honest way to do it.
Yeah, I bought a Solo Blind. Have you seen those, the little barrel, and you spin the glasses around inside of it?
No, but that sounds cool. I like it.
Welcome to the Solo Blind. Okay. And then what I did with the Solo Blind is I bought gold glasses.
Nice.
So I can't see the color, right?
Yeah.
Tequila inside. And what you do is you write what the tequila is on this little dog tag. You put it in this little thing here.
That's cool.
And then when you cover it, right? So now you can't see it. You hit the spin button and you lift it up and they're spinning.
Dude, that's hilarious. I love it.
Now you don't know what they are. And then when they're done, you pull them out. You line them up and then you do your tasting and then you see what they are.
See what it is.
It is a true way to, you know, not my wife lost her job. Like, I don't know if she was able to get workers' compensation after I bought this, but, you know, she would pour all my blinds for me. But then I was using clear glasses, so it was great for still strengths. But as soon as you throw a repo in there, you're like, ah, that's, you know, this one.
Yeah.
So I did the gold glasses because the black ones are still on back order. These are very difficult to get. You get it at Just Neat. I think it's justneat.com, but it may be justneat.org or net.
Okay.
When they become available, they sell out like 4 days before they're available. And then you have to wait. My wife, I seen it. I was like, I'm going to buy that. And she's like, don't. And I was like, okay. And then she bought it that night and gave it to me.
That's cool.
A great way to, I do it all the time, not just on video. Like I'll get a couple of tequilas and I want to do a taste of it. So what I do is I throw it in there against a couple of base tequilas for me.
Yeah.
And it's funny how like sometimes my base like wins out 100% and other times I'm like, holy crap, that was better than one of my base tequilas that I like.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. Removing that preconceived notion of what it is, and then I'm already going to like it. Let you experience more of the nose, the taste, the finish, and everything that's going on in a more pure way.
Yeah, I agree. So it's pretty cool.
Here's what I do at the end of every blind, and you tell me if this happens to you. So at the end of every blind, I'll have, you know, four glasses, and I dump them all together into one glass. And then I drink that one glass and I go inside. Why is it the blend of all of them still tastes better than one of them on their own?
I don't know if it does. I think it's because you already had four tequilas.
once I blend them all together, I'm like, damn.
Yeah, without a doubt. Because before you did your tasting, you probably had some anyway.
Correct.
And then you did your tasting. And then you're like, you know, this blend all together is great. And actually, it doesn't mean it's bad. There's definitely things that, you know, like if we took our individual barrels and we put them all together separately, they would all be really beautiful on their own. But like we do with the Cowboy Bar, by blending different things together, you create different levels of complexity. It's similar to the way that winemakers will look at how they approach, do they make a single varietal wine? It's only Cabernet Sauvignon with nothing else. Or do you blend multiple things together to create complexity? Because each one of those different grapes adds something else. Same thing with agave, different fermentations or different production times of the year or different, even if you just use a little bit of wild yeast with a little bit of, you know, normal proprietary yeast, or you blend in different barrels, each one of them is going to add something else to it. So there are some bottles of wine that are really beautiful on their own as a single varietal. But inherently, when you add different things together, you're going to add complexity as long as it's done in the right way. You can add things. Sometimes we'll make blends and I'm like, that's not right. Those two things shouldn't be together. And so we're like, all right, that one doesn't make it. But you know, so taking different, especially if you're comparing four different Blancos from different producers that all have a slightly different style, when you blend them all together, some of those stylistic points will win out.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them will just get muted and you won't even notice them. But you could certainly create something that's more complex by doing it that way, depending on what you're blending and how it's made. So I would say that it might taste better sometimes. And sometimes Brad just likes it because it's his last shot at tequila.
That's probably it. So everything you've done is Highland Agave, harvested at night, removing the cogoya, and then going in it and cooking that whole and creating all agave from Highland agaves. Have you thought about doing that same process and doing Valles agave to see how that changes the profile and what you guys do?
I haven't, but there's no reason why we couldn't. I think it'll be one of those differences where it'll be, it also depends on how we cook it, but it'll be something where you can tell it's ours, but it's a little bit different, right? One of the things that we learn by cooking it whole is that there are different flavors and aromas you get specifically because we have a 4-day cook time. That because, you know, I mean, you, when you just cook agave normally, when we had the early conversations about how it was going to work with our brand and our distillery, you know, they would ask us, well, you know, what sort of aromas are you looking for out of the cook? Because if we change it by 1 degree, or we change it by a few hours or a half a day, you're going to get different flavors at the end of it. So just by changing the way you cook it, you're going to develop different aromas and flavors. So by changing it to whole in the way we do it, we have a whole different set of parameters now to work with. And I think that's one of the things that makes our tequila unique. It's one of the parts of it that, because there isn't anything that really tastes like cambio. And I'm not saying that makes it, you know, automatically better. I'm just saying it makes our flavor profile different and unique. We get that way because of how we cook and because of how we do fermentation, because of the yeast that we choose. It's all these little changes add up to creating a completely different product than what other brands are able to create. But definitely cooking whole produces different aromas and flavors, than doing it, you know, a traditional way. And also, you know, a 4-day cook time wouldn't work if you had them, if you didn't have them whole. So yeah, it's just one of those things. It just comes out in a different way.
So when you do that long cook, like most people are doing a 10 to 12 hour cook, and then they're shutting off all of the steam and they're dumping all of what we call bitter honeys, but there's no honey in there. It's just dirt.
Right.
So yeah. Do you do a longer initial before you dump the bitter honeys before you go into your basic cook, or are you still doing that same 10 to 12 hour cleanse of the agave and dump it out?
I'm trying to find the best way to answer this without telling you how we do it. I sort of, I will say that, we do a similar cook and a similar discard. We discard a little bit differently than most people do. We don't discard as much, and it tastes different than the normal bitterness you would get out of it. So
I'm going to assume that because you're not cutting them and you're not going through that process, you also don't have as much dirt and waste on the plant that some people would have.
We have zero on the plant. Like our plants go in the oven, they're still wet on the outside when we put the plants in the oven, because they're that fast out of the farms. So we have no moisture loss at all. There's no drying. There's no chemical reaction between the plant, because we don't spend 2 or 3 days waiting where the starches start to break down. So our plants also are not harvested in fields that have dirt on them. A properly mature agave field should spend the last 2 to 2.5 years of its life with a ground cover grown. So the rows are actually filled with plants, with different flowers and plants to help regenerate the soil, that are between 1 foot and 2 feet tall. So when our agave gets cut down, it's laying on top of grass. There's no soil absorbed, or there's no soil at all.
So you don't have a clean crew going in before.
No, as soon as it's done, they grind it all up and put it right back in the soil and plant new crop of grass for it. So,
I mean, I've seen so many different types of production.
And everybody has a different way to do it, you know. And then, like I said, I've seen guys that they'll pay people to manicure the fields until the day they harvest it. And that's fine for their particular way if that's how they want to do it. That isn't necessarily the best thing for the soil though. And when you care about sustainability and you care about the quality of the next agave that's going to go in that farm, we want to get that soil ready to receive as 2 cover crops and then or as 3 cover crops and then agave later after that. So everything gets harvested, it's laying on top of grass or in flowers, and then it gets put inside of a really clean truck. When it goes into our ovens, it's perfectly clean. There is nothing on the agave at all. And so it just starts cooking that way. So there's a little bit of a difference. We have a pure product going into it. It's also really, really fresh. So our bitter honeys aren't quite as bitter as what you would normally expect. And we don't take off as much as everybody would. So see, just a little bit different.
I literally was thinking you probably had to go longer since you were whole versus shorter. So that's a good explanation of that. And for some people that don't understand what we're even talking about, you go into the steam turns on, the steam is washing the agave, and they call it bitter honeys, but usually there's no honey there because the agave's not cooked yet, right?
It's right. Just
cleaning all of the things off the agave, you dump that out, and then you turn
it. There's all the usually it's the natural waxes on the outside of the plant, and also the natural juices that come out of the stems in the very beginning. They just produce bitter, astringent aromas and flavors, and so you don't want them inside of your fermentation when you get to the end. So, but there's different ways for everyone to do it, but with our process and how long we cook for, we do take off some of the honeys. It's not as much, it's not quite the same time frame, but also our process overall, remember, is a lot slower. It's a third longer than everyone else's process is. And we do three different temperature changes for a specific set of time during that longer process. And our temperature modulates. It isn't the same. It just doesn't go up or just go down. It actually goes up and then down and up and then down a little bit. So, our trick wasn't just figuring out how to cook it whole, but also how do we get the right flavor out of it? What do we want it to taste like when we combine it with our yeast later? And because it isn't just how do we cook it now and what is that going to make agave like? How do we cook this version now and combine it with this yeast in this tank, and how is it going to be later on? All of those things had to be thought about and considered. We don't just, throw everything together and say whatever happens, happens. We were intentional about all those different choices, and that makes it sometimes difficult to produce without the right people watching it and doing it. We've got four people that work for us now in Mexico that literally oversee our entire production. Every other small brand, and they all make great tequila, but all those brands are going to a distillery. And they're working with the distillery to create the tequila, and then the distillery executes the entire thing for them, right? They'll source glass, they'll source labels, capsules, boxes. They'll make all the juice for them, they'll source the agave, and then they'll give them a final product, and they have to pay for that final product. That's the way that a normal small brand would do things. And we don't do any of that stuff, right? We source everything ourselves. We buy our own glass, we buy our own labels. We source our own boxes. We directly source all of our own agave and pay for it directly from our farmers. And then we oversee all of our tequila production. We even load and unload our own ovens.
Wow.
Because the distillery finally said, listen, our guys don't want to load whole pinas. We're not going to do this for you anymore at all. And we're like, what are you talking about? He said, it's too hard. We don't want to do it. So we now have to, we actually have our, the biggest guys on our Jimadores crews drive with the trucks to the distillery, and there's four guys, and those guys load the ovens. And when we're done cooking it, they'll unload the ovens. They'll cut it in half because our distillery has flat conveyor belts. It doesn't have, some conveyor belts have the notches. So we don't. I don't know why.
They'd roll the whole.
Oh my God. It's the first time they started rolling down. I'm like, fuck, we got to cut it afterwards. So we have to have the guys come back after we're done, and they're fucking chopping cooked agave. Every time we do this, people are laughing at us. And so I told them this year, we need to get new conveyor belts that have the notches so they don't roll down, so we can just throw them inside whole. But even that, sometimes the pinas are big enough where they won't fit inside of the hopper in the hammer mill. So we need to cut them anyway. So it's just like one more thing. It's like everything that we did was hard. And then there were side effects of doing it. Like the distillery says, we're not going to load your ovens. That's a side effect of us wanting to do it whole. So I know I just got the bill from Valerie and paid for, last quarter's production. And it's way too much for just loading and unloading ovens. I wrote back to her and said, Valerie, I said, why is this so much? Like, how can it be 100,000 pesos for a few months to unload and load the ovens? Only that one tiny task of all the things that we do. And she's like, John, I checked. The time is right. The batches are right. This is, you wanted to do it this way. I always get this is what you wanted.
Yeah, answer. This is what you wanted. I can hear my wife saying that. So knowing you go into your cook time and you're going to be longer, is your rest time even longer to be able to handle the agaves? Because that's part of what a lot of distilleries tell me about. We have to let it cool for this amount of time to be able to handle. With them being whole, is that even a longer time as well?
It is, and it's longer for two ways. Well, it's our finishing temperature isn't as high as a normal finishing temperature, right? Because the process is longer and slower, and we actually finish at a lower temperature. But commonly what happens is you'll open up the ovens and you'll put fans in front of the ovens, and you'll just blow air through it to cool it off quicker. But they did that once at the distillery, and I saw them doing it. I said, listen, you got to tell them to stop doing that. And they're like, well, it's going to take longer to cool off. I said, I know. But when they're blowing it, I said, they're drying everything out. I said, stop drying stuff. We want to keep it moist when it goes into all this. So don't do that. Tell them to open up the ovens a little bit. So they'll open them halfway and they'll let it sit there. So we'll usually open them up in the afternoon time, and the next morning we'll go in and actually start pulling it out and start crushing them. But yeah, everything takes longer. The whole thing takes longer. But every choice we made was going to take more time. So at this point, it takes us a month to make our tequila from start to finish, almost a month, from total time to finish. What's one more day with a whole month or with 3.5 weeks in here?
So knowing that most people cook between like 95 and 100 degrees Celsius, are you even below that temperature during your cook time? Am I supposed to know that information?
No, nobody's supposed to know it.
Okay, I get it. I understand your answer.
I will tell you that, one of the things that there were a few things that we wanted in the very beginning, in the early days, when we talked to master distillers and they told us that what we wanted to do was not going to work, and or some ideas just weren't good ideas, or it would be too difficult or too time consuming or too whatever. One of the things that everybody told us is that it wasn't possible to cook whole, and there wasn't a way that you would cook the outside too fast, the inside would be raw, or you would cook it wrong and you would produce too much foufarales, and then you'd have to filter all the tequila later, and it would be nothing but problems. And so
foufarales are bad alcohol that is created.
Yeah, it's a serious problem. Yeah. It only gets people, but it's only mildly poisonous. So, and I know we've made batches that had too much. And so we did it, I think twice that happened, where the ovens actually got too hot. And that happens sometimes, right? Even we have three ovens at the distillery, and every one of them cooks a little bit differently from the one next to it. They don't all cook exactly the same. I can't get anybody to explain why that happens, but it's the same oven of the same size and the same construction and the same steam, but they don't work the same way.
Is
so
it
we'll
the
actually cook differently
every
in the ovens.
Kitchen you have?
Yeah, like every stove isn't quite the same, right?
Okay.
Same thing. Even in your house, if you've got like side-by-side ovens, one is a little bit different than the one next to it. So it just works that way. So we had a couple batches with too much, and we had to take like 5% out, and you run it through a special filter. I think the University of Guadalajara developed a special filter for taking that one chemical out and not doing anything else. But we all the batches we made, we had two of them, I think, that were a little bit too high, so we had to filter it. Anyway, but the point is that you've got to be careful of that. And if you overcook your agave, you're always going to run into that problem. Everybody just told us that it wasn't going to work. And so when you're trying to create a new brand and you want to do things that are unusual or different, and every really important person you talk to tells you it's a dumb idea or it won't work that way, you really run into... at some point you're like, all right, maybe we don't know what we're doing and we shouldn't be trying to make it like this, right? And I freely admit, I had moments of that when I'd wake up in the middle of the night, I'm like, we're going to ruin everything by doing it like this.
We're going to have to call mezcal.
Yeah, or God, I mean, we got to call it an agave spirit, right? But I think that, it's one of the things that we've done well is to persevere through the general attitude of you shouldn't be doing it that way or you can't do it that way. And really, sit down and say, we think that we can make tequila differently and do it well and respect heritage and tradition. We took our whole team down to Mexico, all of our sales team down to Mexico last February. We were two things. One is we wanted to show everybody physically how we make stuff. So we got up at 2 o'clock in the morning and drove out to the farm and watched all the guys harvest it. So we're all out there with headlamps on in the dark. And it's a really cool picture of all these little headlamps watching guys with headlamps cutting down agave. And we brought we brought all the humidors, beanies that had Bluetooth in them, so that they, because it was cold. We went up in February, and it's cold up. It was 9,000 feet February in Jalisco. It's not warm. So we brought them really nice beanies, and they could play music in their ears and listen to their kids wake up in the morning, because they're all, you know, it's difficult. It's a hard job. They're up at 2 o'clock in the morning, work until 11 or 12 o'clock, so that they can do as much as they can to provide for their families. And they're not there when their kids wake up in the morning. So now they can get phone calls and listen to and everything in their ears. And plus they got headlamps in the front. So they get a warm head, Bluetooth music in their ears, and a headlamp to see everything really well. So anyway, we took our whole team down there, and we had a really cool tour of how we're going to do trips in Mexico. We've got a great format of a nice integration between how tequila is made, how we make it, and the culture of Jalisco specifically. There's a lot of really cool things that we did. And see, I started this whole story and I forgot what the point of the whole thing was. I do this all the time.
The
I start
point
talking
is,
about one
we're
days.
Gonna go do a trip together. That's the
oh,
point.
Oh yeah. Okay, got it. All right. So in the middle of this trip, we were having lunch at a restaurant just outside of one of the farms that we were harvesting from, and Anna Maria was there with a couple of, she makes mi gente, and I forgot that, but she makes like 15 or 20 brands. She's like the best female master distiller there is, right? And she's incredible. And so she was at a table with some clients, and Valerie, my cousin, actually got her agave som certification from Anna Maria. This is like 4 years before we were all sitting there. And so Valerie gets up and they go over with Jason, who's our guy from the mountains. And he used to work for Mijenta. And so he knows Anna Maria. I'm like, can you guys go over and take her our tequila and just show her what we did and just tell her about it and pour it at the table. And just, you know, I want to share it with them. I want them to see what it's like. And it was honestly just a really good positive moment of different approaches and high quality people sharing the same things together. And everybody was really happy. She was unbelievably gracious. And I think that the one of the really neat moments about it was that she had asked my cousin, you know, who makes this for you? And Valerie said, no, we make it. And she said, no, who's your master distiller? And Valerie said, we don't have one. We make it. And Anna Maria had a really hard time grasping that there wasn't a person in charge of making our tequila, that we had sat down and done all of these things together. And we didn't actually have a master distiller. We still don't have one now. We make our tequila the way that we want to make it. And we think that there's a really positive outcome to it, and that we make it a really nice, beautiful spirit. And honestly, we don't have one because everybody we asked told us to fuck off. So there wasn't really anybody that we could lean on. And there wasn't enough experience in the way that we do it. You know, nobody had ever worked with the yeast that we worked with, and nobody ever cooked it that way before. And the idea of harvesting it and getting it inside of an oven in the span of 10 or 12 hours is not a normal thing. I know there's a couple of brands that will start cooking on the same day that they harvest it. But we literally cut the plants down and drive them to the distillery and start cooking that way. So it's usually between 10 to 12 hours after the plant's cut, we're already cooking it. So all that stuff is just, you know, there's not really a point to any of this. The whole point was, you know, that we just had different ways of looking at it. And that's what we went for. And some people tell us we got really lucky. You know, and I think there's a lot of underlying current of, well, you know, your tequila tastes nice, you just got lucky. But I think that we approached it with thoughtful choices and with a lot of intention and a lot of experience behind it, you know. So it's one thing to say we're going to cook it differently. It's another piece to say we think the yeast is going to work. All we did was take the best techniques that already existed that they've developed over 500 years. And we just tried to see if we could tweak those things a little bit to make a new style of tequila, right? So it isn't as ridiculous and out of the box. You know, we didn't go make tequila by using barley, you know, and we just took really good technique that we know works well. I think traditionally made tequila is important. And I think that there's a real place for it in the modern world. I know that most brands, well, every brand that's been started in the last 15 years doesn't approach it that way. They all use some version of modern technique to do it. But I think that you can make traditional tequila and you can make it profitably. And, you know, that's one of the things we wanted to do, was we wanted to, you know, always pass the cousin test.
I will say that every master distiller that I have shared your tequila with, which has been several, and talked about how you make it, they look at me sideways, they taste it, and then they all have the same response. And it is a response of respect. They're like,
no way, really?
Wow, that is really good. And yes, there is a handful of master distillers that I have shared your tequila with, had them tell me what they think about it and tell them how you do it. And they all have been, wow, that's really good. Wow, that's amazing. Wow, they did it that way. So I could take you on a tour of some master distillers that have tasted your tequila that make fantastic tequila as well. And the beauty to that conversation is you could sit down with them and totally respect and get excited about everything that they do as much as they would about what you do. And I think that's really important, being not a master distiller, but coming up with these ideas and coming from it as a chef's perspective of how to make things great without changing a tradition or history. I think you've done a fantastic job of that. It's impressive.
Wow. Dude, that's really, I've never had anybody express something like that before. So I appreciate that. I also didn't know you were giving it to him. That kind of scares me a little bit.
So here's what I do. I have great tequilas given to me, and I share them with other people who make great tequila, because, you know, it's one thing to sit with my friend Jimmy Salza and watch the sunset over the San Martin Mountains, which is, you know, going all the way back to Sabana Salsa and the history of tequila, and him sharing with me a tequila or a ricea or a mixto, and going, wow, what is this? And me saying, hey, try this. I brought this for you to taste. And he's like, what is that? That's amazing. And being able to share those experiences with Rene Carranza and Ileana Partida and Sergio Cruz and Oscar Vazquez, and having them say, wow, it's fun to see not only the faces of brand owners taste something and say, wow, but also master distillers taste things and say, wow, right?
Yeah.
You know, Sergio Cruz says it the best. He's my favorite person that says this. He said to me one day, I'm going to use my best Sergio Cruz accent when I do this. He says to me, you know, I got to tell you that no master distiller ever makes a mistake. They only make a new profile, maybe bad profile.
My God, I love it. That's so good.
And he's like, it's true. Like, we experiment. We make a new profile. No one may drink this one. Like, this may need to go in with the vinyasas and completely take it out to the fields, but it's a new profile. And I love that about him. I love how he'll share what he's doing and how he did it. And Sergio is right now probably one of the most inventive, exciting master distillers in the business. But I say that, which, you know, Jimmy and Ileana and Tony Saez and Rene Carranza, they all, Felipe, Carlos, Jenny, they all fit in that same category, right? Everybody's doing great things, but it is great to take something to somebody that they haven't tasted it. And I love intermingling the tequilas and the people. And I've done that with yours several times. So no, I'm a fan, just so you know.
Yeah. I know. Thank you. I think being a fan is different than giving it to some of those guys and saying, hey, try this.
But the thing is I'm a fan of what they do too.
Yeah, me too.
It's kind of like,
I think that's the thing. Like, all of us, we all love and we're always excited about all the things that everyone is doing. Like, it is always a positive conversation. I've never heard anybody who makes really beautiful tequila talking in a negative way about other people that make beautiful tequila, right? Yeah. Like, we're all excited. And we all want everything. We all want the best thing for each other every single day. I mean, I think that's a really, really positive thing that's unique with tequila and unique with the Mexican culture, is that everybody wants everyone else to succeed who makes really great stuff. And we all understand that the more success that all of us smaller brands have, it's going to breed better tequila. It's going to get more people drinking what they should be drinking. And we're all going to win at the end of it. I mean, taking the industry from 15% additive free to 40% additive free in the next 5 or 6 years would be life altering for an incredible amount of people that deserve it, and also for the industry in the future. And I think we'll get there. I don't think what I just said is unreasonable. I think it is a completely attainable goal. I would love it if those guys at Cuervo, for that little tiny brand they made, like, go help us make more like that. Right? Start talking about the way that Jose actually made his tequila and people used to actually drink it. Don't lie to people. I'm like, there's been too many people from that company that are trying to continually convince consumers that, oh no, it's always been this way. We've always made shitty tequila with a machine the size of a whole building and then put stuff inside of it. That isn't true. That isn't the way it's always been made. Because when you just make normal tequila using the old methods of making it, it's beautiful. It tastes great.
Yep.
Right? All the modern stuff is new. This didn't exist 150 years ago or 200 or 300 years ago. You can make really nice tequila just normally by cooking a plant and crushing it and fermenting the juice and distilling it. That's all you have to do to make beautiful tequila. It isn't rocket science. It's literally not rocket science, right?
Now, when I explain to people—
Their job, the way they make it now is harder than making it traditionally. It's cheaper, but it's actually more difficult. Yeah.
It's agave vodka, you know?
And yeah.
When I explain to people that most distilleries that are making traditional tequila fit in my barn right here, right where I'm sitting, I can fit Fortaleza right in here, right? Maybe not their new part, but their old part. And then when I talk about the fact that a diffuser is the size of a basketball court.
Yeah.
Literally a professional basketball court is the size of a diffuser to do what it does. And understanding those things. People are wanting to learn, though. These videos, these hour plus explanations of how it's made get more views and people spend more time watching these than my silly reviews. The reviews are fun, but I can't do an interview every day because I don't have time.
Yeah, nobody has time for this every day.
So I want to transition just a little bit and not take up a whole bunch more time, but you have produced one of the things I'm most excited about trying. I'm an espresso martini guy, right? And I have converted several restaurants in the Indianapolis area to stop making their espresso martinis with vodka and make them with tequila and not even tell people that it's a tequila espresso martini. They are better for you. They taste better. You don't wake up with a hangover and you have more of a complex espresso martini.
Totally.
About these coffee drinks you got, because I can't wait to try this stuff.
I know. I should have grabbed the bottle all the way downstairs right now. Because you don't have one. I promise I will get on sending you one. It'll go out. I'll place the order right now. It'll go out. You'll have it in 2 days. So I think I'm going to give you the spiel that we generally tell people about coffee liqueur. I don't love most coffee liqueurs. I think they all suffer from one of three different flaws, or some of them suffer from all of them. They're too sweet and sugary.
Yep.
They don't have enough coffee.
Yep.
And they don't have enough ABV. So about 9-10 months ago, God, it's been almost a year now, I started to think about like how would Cambio make a coffee liqueur? Like if we could make one, what would we do? What would be the base spirit? How would we control the coffee? What type of sugar would we add to it? What would the flavor profile be? So I sat down and I thought about, you know, where is the coffee? When I'm in Mexico, where does the coffee come from? And I think I always tell this because most Americans don't understand that there's a lot of coffee grown in Mexico and most of it doesn't leave the country. Mexicans drink it all and they grow beautiful coffee in every state. Not every state. I think there's eight or nine states that grow coffee, maybe 10.
Isn't Chiapas like the best, though, of all the coffee?
So the coffee we use comes from Chiapas. It's the southernmost state in Mexico. It borders Guatemala and it looks like mountainous and jungle. Like it's the perfect coffee growing place. It's my favorite state where it comes from. So I chose that to make this product with.
Oh, no kidding. Didn't know that. I mean, I knew about the region, but I didn't know that's where you chose.
Yeah. So right off the bat, we made a coffee liqueur with a single origin coffee. That's already, I think it's unheard of. I don't know if somebody is trying to make a large scale liqueur that is made from coffee that comes from one tiny place. But it's my favorite. We wanted to use it. So that's what we started using. And one of the things, and we knew that our Blanco was going to be the base. So Cambio Blanco is the base for the spirit. And I agree with you that tequila is the right spirit for making a coffee liqueur. It's because as a Blanco spirit, like as a white spirit, it has a lot of complexity and a lot of great texture when it's made right to begin with. So when you combine that with coffee, it's a natural synergy that works. I think vodka actually is an angst to coffee and they fight each other a little bit. And when you do that, you've got to fix that by adding other sugar or other flavoring into it. So we use our Blanco as the base. We knew we were going to use Blanco as the base. As you mentioned earlier, when we make our Blanco, we actually distill all the way down to 51%. So there isn't a lot of proof in our Blanco. And one of the things that I wanted to accomplish with the coffee liqueur was to make it a higher proof coffee liqueur, not just make it at 20 or 25%, which is basically what everyone does, with a couple of rare exceptions. So we want a high proof, We want a really strong coffee flavor. And because of the way we make our tequila, we don't have a lot of physical room in the bottle. And so your bottle right now sitting on that table, that's almost how much coffee goes into one bottle of our liqueur.
Of this?
So we put, yeah, we put about a cup of coffee inside of it. Okay. Wow. So that we keep the proof high. So now think about how strong we have to make that coffee to put only that much volume in a bottle and have a really strong, deep, rich coffee flavor. When you get it, you'll understand what this is like. So to do that, we need to make a really strong infusion. And you could do that by making a cold brew, but if you just take water as your base, your end result isn't quite strong enough. But also I wanted the complexity from a warm infusion and a cold infusion at the same time. And each one of them adds different flavors and different complexity. So we do a warm infusion first. So first to make this, we didn't know how we were going to make it. So there's got to be a video somewhere of my cousin and I and Erica, who works for us, of making this first version, because all of our clothes we wore for that 40 period are we burned them. Like they're all gone. There's so much coffee. We couldn't get it out. I think Valerie wore a white shirt on one of those days. And it was brown by the time we left. So what we ended up figuring out is that we needed to make, basically we had to build French presses, okay? And what we built are the world's largest French presses. We built two 1500 liter presses. And what we've got is so we took 1500 liter tanks, and one of them is steam so we can warm up the liquid. And one of them is cold water so we can do a cold brew with it. So we do a warm infusion first. And we built this huge apparatus on top. We built a steel I-beam and we anchored to the floor. And we've got basically this large basket that we raise up and move it over and lower it into the tanks of water. And then we let it sit for a certain amount of time at a certain temperature. It's not hot because I don't want the bitterness from like hot water. It's a warm infusion. So we let it sit for a certain amount of time, pull it up, press it down, squeeze it. And then we take that liquid and we pump that liquid into the cold tank. And then we chill that liquid down. And we take fresh grounds again. So we're making a cold brew with really strong coffee as a base, rather than making a cold brew with just water. So then we put fresh grounds, same way, same thing, new basket, drop it in, and we let it sit for 40 hours. So we do a really, really long cold soak on it. A 40-hour cold brew is an extensive amount of time. But at the end of it, we have all this complexity from both techniques, and we have really, 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 really dense coffee. And it also has a lot of oils that get extracted from it. So the oils we get from the coffee combined with all the natural oils that are inside of our tequila, because we don't strip those out, makes this really luxurious, rich style of coffee liqueur without us having to add glycerin into it or something else. So we literally take our coffee as the base. We add natural cane sugar from Veracruz. So it's crystallized raw sugar. We don't modify it. We don't use a syrup or anything like that. We literally mix the coffee with the sugar and we add the tequila to it. And that's it. That is the entire process of making this liqueur. We don't filter it. So it actually has natural sediment in the bottom of the bottle. That's intentional. We actually wanted to do that. When you look at it in a glass, it has this nice cloudiness to it. If you let it settle, it will settle out of it. So you always have to shake the bottle. And that's it. So it's got 75% less sugar than a normal coffee liqueur. It is a full 80 proof and it has a full strength of coffee. It's actually like a nice dark brown color. So it's really beautiful coffee, really beautiful tequila. So single origin coffee, single origin sugar, and single origin tequila all put together. So it's a completely different product than anything that exists in the category now. Nobody's ever made a coffee liqueur with this much intention and this much quality built into it.
So is that an espresso martini just in a glass? Like
as it is.
Just do I do anything else to it?
You actually have to dilute it.
Really?
It is too much alcohol to make, because if you make an espresso martini with too high alcohol and you shake it, it doesn't form a head. The alcohol dissipates the head. So you dilute it 2-to-1 and then shake it over ice and pour it. And it's an espresso martini out of the pot.
So 2-to-1, what do I add to it? Water?
It's water. Yeah.
So just add water and ice, shake it. And I have.
Done. It'll hold a head for 20 minutes.
And it's a mixologist level espresso martini out of
totally.
The
And so what we've seen people do, and the most common thing that happens, so everyone uses it for cocktails. There's no bar that just throws it on the back bar. Everybody makes something out of it. But it takes them a couple of months to rework their espresso martini recipes and to make other things with it. So we've seen people make everything from Negronis. There's a guy in Dallas Social House that has it on tap. He's got an old fashioned on tap.
No, shit.
Yeah. People make Manhattans out of it. So there's, because it's a high proof and because it has a strong coffee flavor, there's so many more cocktails you can make with this product that you can't make with a normal coffee liqueur. That's been the neat part, is that mixologists look at this, fuck, there's all kinds of stuff I can do with this. You can always add sugar, right? And you can always come down off of an ABV, but you can't fix those two things once it's in the bottle. So we gave everybody a really broad palette to work with. And to follow it up, even though it's only a 6-month-old brand, but we just made a decaf version.
I don't even want to hear about that. That's like a Red Bull.
I'm telling you, caffeine. At 9 o'clock at night, a lot of people need a decaf version.
I can see that.
I mean, 40% of Americans don't drink coffee after 5 o'clock at night.
Yeah, but all these drugs drink espresso martinis.
Yeah, but a lot of them don't. That's a lot of people that don't have one. So now we gave them a product they can handle. We made it with a natural wash process. It's actually a Mexican wash process that they developed down in Guadalajara. And so there's no chemicals or anything like that inside of it. We roast it the same way. We do the same process of extraction with it, with the same two tanks. It tastes exactly the same as the regular. There's no difference at all. So now you've got, in the store, you've got both versions you can buy. And bartenders now have both versions you can buy and you can use, and you can swap them out. So you've actually got a product that people can have a decaffeinated espresso martini at 10 o'clock at night and go home and sleep really great.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So that doesn't exist. Like, nobody's ever done one like that before.
So as a breakfast drunk, can I make a good carajillo out of it?
It makes the best carajillo you ever had, because it fixes the sugar that's inside a liquor 43, which isn't supposed to be there. It's too much.
Sure.
There's an original liquor 43 version from Mexico that's incredible. And it's got about a quarter of the sugar of the modern version. So when you make a carajillo in America, then you use liquor 43 and you use Parral, it's the best. It's the best. It's fucking incredible. It's so yummy.
I can't wait. Everybody's like, are you doing dry January? And I'm like, no, I'm trying to do dry mornings. Like, leave me alone. Carajillo is like my go-to like Mexican drink. I love it. I don't drink it at home. You know, I drink sugar-free Red Bull at home. But when I'm in Mexico, it's a carajillo every morning. And,
all the time. Yeah. It's great. You could totally use it for that, for sure.
But John, I've stolen an hour and 30 minutes of your evening. I want to say thank you so much for doing this.
My pleasure.
So informational, so fun to talk to. I can't wait to grab a steak with you next time you're in town. But I also want to make that trip up to Chicago and come visit some of your amazing award-winning restaurants, where my friends tell me that I have to call you to get a reservation because they're so good. So I definitely have to take you up on that.
That'd be cool. We got to do a show when you come up here. We have to find a way to do a show up here at one of the restaurants. That'd be cool.
I got a camera. I got microphones. We'll make it happen.
That's easy.
And just so you know, I've told you this before, Mi Casa Su Casa, if you're in this area, my bar is here for you to come drink at. You can stay here. You can go out to the track and race BMWs and Porsches whenever you want to. You just let me know. And I just want to say thanks so much. Thanks for making great tequila. Thanks for taking the time to educate people about it, because one thing that you do that a lot of others don't, and I really appreciate that about you. And thanks for your time tonight. I appreciate you so much.
My pleasure, man. I love it. Anytime. Good seeing you. Thanks.
I'll take you up on that. Cheers.
You got it.